This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week, the Missouri Supreme Court heard arguments in the matter of indefinitely suspending former prosecutor Amy McGowan's law license. McGowan was the Jackson County prosecutor in the case of Ricky Kidd, who was charged with committing a double homicide back in 1996. Ricky Kidd was convicted and sent to prison. It would be 23 years before Ricky Kidd would be exonerated of those killings and released. Since then, Kidd has worked to highlight the issue of wrongful prosecution and the work to exonerate others. He's developed a training program called The Cost of a Prosecutor's Decision, and the first group he presented it to was the very office that prosecuted him. That was the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office. Joining me now to explain the program is Ricky Kidd. And Ricky, always good to have you on this program. Welcome back.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you. I appreciate it. When we get to have the opportunity to have these important discussions.
You know, take us back to your case, Ricky. I've always wondered how you were able to navigate the legal process all the while knowing you were an innocent man, you know, serving time in prison. What kind of mental gymnastics were you going through in those days?
Oh, it was a tough go in the early years, Steve. Of course, I was thrust into a criminal legal system that I had no education surrounding. So everything was new, and the trauma and the negative impact of being wrongfully convicted always hovered over me. And so I really had to find a way to A, process the emotional aspect of what I was going through, but B, find a way in my mental capacity to fight back and make my way home.
Were you assuming, you know, all along that the legal system would eventually clear you, Ricky, because all these smart men and women who work in that system, they would eventually figure this thing out?
I absolutely walked into the system believing that it was just going to be an inconvenience, that it was going to be a mistake discovered, and that I wouldn't have to ultimately face a trial and a jury. I believed that the whole time I was in the county jail leading up to trial. And then even after conviction, I always believed that the next appeal, they're going to get it right, that the next court is going to see that a mistake was made. And that just wasn't the case for 23 years and 11 appeals before I won my final last appeal.
Did you ever wind up, you know, directly interacting with the prosecutor's office outside of the courtroom?
Let me slow down. Yes, I did. I remember, or at least me communicating with their office. I remember sitting in a county jail, pleading to my public defender, pleading to anybody who would listen that I'm innocent. And I also remember sending over letters and pictures against my legal or my lawyer's advice. I was sending over these pictures of, I had a baby that was in the belly of my then girlfriend, Monica Gray. And I was letting them know that they was making a mistake. Pictures of my family. And my lawyer came over and she said, listen, I told you not to do that. And I'm going to continue to encourage you not to do that. Ricky, I hear that they're putting it on a bulletin board and laughing at you. They're laughing at your outcry that you're innocent. They never seen anything like that, I suppose. And they was actually making fun of me.
You know, knowing that you were innocent, what did you make of the prosecutor going forward with the case? What was going through your mind at that time?
I thought that she was overreaching. I did not see what I now believe is the evil part of Amy McGowan. I do believe that about her as a prosecutor, not about all prosecutors, far from, but I didn't see that. I didn't see the depth and the level of how far she was willing to go to secure a conviction. But I did think that it was a little heavy-handed, that it was a little aggressive, and that there was myopic in scope, that they was narrow-minded in seeing the facts and not opening their eyes to see the fuller picture. And so that was a turnoff as I went through the court process during trial. And maybe if I had a little bit more education surrounding the criminal legal system, I would have been able to dig a little deeper and see that I was in much, much, much more trouble than I initially thought.
Do you remember what details that Amy McGowan was presenting during the trial that, you know, you just knew were flat out wrong? And for the record, I couldn't reach Amy McGowan for comment yesterday.
Yeah, I bet. I think when she there was a time where she was trying to get the little girl that survived losing her father and her father's friend. I saw how she was trying to coerce the little girl on the stand when the little girl was not able to identify me, how she was trying to say to the courts that make all these different excuses for why she could not identify me at the time. I believe that they coerced her, or that they lied, the prosecutor and the police department for that matter, about that identification. But also there was a critical point in the trial where they had found fingerprints on the other suspect's vehicle, the individuals who were likely to have committed this crime. And Amy allowed the forensic expert to testify that those fingerprints came from my vehicle without correcting her. And so that, again, we should have known that we was dealing with somebody who was not playing from an ethical deck of cards, if you will.
Is part of the problem here with how prosecutors pursue a case that they wind up, you know, focusing on finding facts, you know, evidence and testimony that all is going to support a finding of guilt, and they don't wind up looking for evidence of innocence?
Yes, I do believe that. And we have discovered that. Listen, I didn't just wake up one day and say, you know what, I'm going to start training, or I'm going to start lending my voice to this. I've been studying this issue for years. Those decades that I was in prison, many of those years I had began the studying process of really understanding this issue, and then having the privilege, Steve, to really interact with investigators, with lawyers, and some other prosecutors, some retired prosecutors, who really gave me the insight as it relates to how these individuals come up with their thinking process and how they are making their decision. And that's what made me realize, you know what, we need a training program, a continued legal education program that helps open their eyes to how they're thinking and how to make better choices.
You know, did your legal team eventually come to view Amy McGowan much the same way that you were, Ricky, that she was just outright unethical?
Yes. I think that is an emphatic yes. And not just my legal team. The judge, the Honorable Darren Atkins, issued a 107-page ruling. And in that ruling, he was not shy or sheepish about what he felt or believed from Amy's testimony when she took the stand. So it just wasn't myself or my legal team, but it was the courts as well who really thought that she did not play fair.
And just to be crystal clear here, Ricky, if a prosecutor finds evidence of innocence, that prosecutor has to disclose it, right?
That is correct. You have to turn that over, whether you want to or not, whether you think it is of value or not. And I remember Amy, in my opinion, she was caught, sort of, if you will, with her hand in a cookie jar, because during that hearing process, she acknowledged that she did not. And then they said, well, why? Well, I didn't think that I had to. I didn't think she was really trying to minimize why she did not turn this information over, knowing very well, ethically and according to ABA codes and standards, that that evidence was supposed to be turned over.
And that was an astonishing admission from Amy McGowan, right? That she would admit that, hey, I didn't know I had to turn that stuff over.
Yeah, it was. And it was quite shocking. It was a dagger, as the way I saw it, as a dagger in the case against Amy, because she acknowledged that she had this information, that she could have turned this information over, but that she did not. And then she began to try to justify the reasons why she did not. But once again, to the listening audience, that's not her choice to make, according to the law, constitutional law, and policy and procedures and standards surrounding prosecutors' behavior.
You know, there's another factor I wanted to ask you about here, Ricky. I mean, police have their clearance rates, which, you know, keep track of how often they solve crimes. I assume prosecutor's office keep track of statistics that show what percentage of cases each prosecutor handles that wind up in a conviction. And I'm wondering how much of all of that sort of mindset towards getting great stats contribute to the problem we're talking about here today.
Yeah, I I think it's a big problem, Steve, in our criminal legal system. If we go back historically, we have established in the United States an adversarial system. And so that helps bring these behaviors into play. And when these individuals, I assume, authentic, genuine individuals who go inside the DA's office, who's not looking to hurt anybody or harm anybody or send innocent people to prison, but the idea is that I need to stack these numbers and that I'm willing to do it at any cost. And they can forget the real cost to the wrongfully convicted individual, the wrongfully convicted individual's family, or the community, when the real killer may be still about roaming to harm others.
I'm visiting with Ricky Kidd, who spent 23 years in prison for a crimes he didn't commit. He's developed a new program for prosecutor's office aimed at focusing on wrongful convictions. You know, since your release, you've been very active with the Innocence Project, telling your story, helping fellow exonerees like Kevin Strickland, who also spent decades in prison for crimes he didn't commit. When did the idea for this training program for prosecutors start to take hold?
Yeah, well, it would have been within the first year. I came home August 15, 2019. And so if we date a year, we're talking about August of 2020. Of course, we was locked down during COVID as well. But I had crossed the country, traveled enough when we could not travel, virtualed enough, extremely active in engaging the community, doing these various speaking engagements. And it helped me understand that, wait a minute, if the most powerful individual in our criminal legal system are prosecutors, then why can't we start there and understand how to better support them, not just wag our fingers at them, not just make these accusations once they do the wrong thing, but how can we actually support them from on the onset to make sure that they're not making these type of mistakes where innocent individuals go to prison. So it would have been in 2000 or 2020 that my wife and I began to sit down over the next 3 to 5 months, and we started creating the costs of a prosecutor's decision, blind spots of true justice.
You ask prosecutors in your training if they've come into contact with an innocent person. Why do you ask that question?
That's because most prosecutors have not come in contact with an innocent individual. And so there's a gap there in believing that innocent people are actually not innocent, that those are guilty people just trying to get out of prison. There's a prevalent thought that that's around the country that people are buying into that idea. So that they don't, again, prosecutors often don't believe that individuals are innocent, or they don't have an opportunity to be in the same room with an innocent individual who is sharing his story.
Because they're presumed to be guilty, not innocent, is what you're suggesting here.
They are presumed to be innocent. I mean, yes, that is correct. They're presumed to be innocent and not guilty.
You know,
guilty and not innocent.
I'm sorry, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. That's the assumption I think many of them are making. In your view, you say it's important to bring prosecutors, in your words, closeness to innocence, meaning what exactly?
Yeah, I call it proximity to innocence. Mm-hmm. When we get in proximity of a thing or anything different from what we are used to or accustomed to or things that we've seen, it has the opportunity to change our perspective on that particular thing or that particular point of view. And so one of the things that I really thought that was so important about the training was the proximity that it would give prosecutors to innocence or an exonerated individual. You could take Professor Sean O'Brien, who ushered me out those doors. You could take many great-minded individuals and put them in front of prosecutors and offer some of the training tools that we offer now, but they are professors. They're not an exonerated individual. And I just think it bodes well and it feels different when the prosecutor gets to see the result of a mistake in their face.
You know, what you spent these years in prison, I've been around prisons often enough to know just in interviewing people that, you know, lots of people in prison think they're innocent. As you spent your 23 years in prison, how often did you come across a fellow inmate that you thought, you know, that guy got jammed up here, I think he's innocent.
Yeah, I would say anywhere from a half a dozen to a dozen who I really believed were actually innocent. There may be another half a dozen to a dozen who probably had something there to worthy of a second look. But those are serious numbers. And to just help context the question, when you ask that question, Kevin Strickland, I was in prison with Kevin Strickland, Anthony Dixon, who was just released as well from the work of the Midwest Innocence Project and New York lawyers. I was in prison with Anthony Dixon, individuals who are saying that they're innocent, Michael Polite, who was just released as well. I was in prison with Michael Polite, who said he was innocent. So it's not just in theory. How many people, Ricky, have you come in contact while in prison who were believed to be innocent or you thought was innocent? They're real individuals who have since come home because of the fact that they were innocent.
Ricky Kidd is my guest. He spent 23 years in prison for crimes he didn't commit. He's developed a new program for a prosecutor's office focused on wrongful convictions. Let's go to Mike from South Kansas City. Mike, you're on Up to Date. You're on with Ricky Kidd.
Yes, thank you. Ricky, my question is, did you, back many years ago when there was more belief in it, did you ever ask for a lie detector test to prove your innocence? And if you did, what advice did you get from your attorney or anybody else? That's it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, yeah. Mike.
Yeah, thank you as well. Good question, Mike. I did. I asked for every and anything that could prove my innocence. Or prove my innocence during that time. But I recall my lawyer telling me that those lie detectors are not reliable. And it's not, I don't believe it was as much as that I couldn't take the test or that it wasn't available. She wasn't available. My public defender, I seen her four times in 11 months at about 30 minutes each time. So we're talking about 2 hours over the course of a year where my lawyer prepared for a double homicide trial. So a lot of the things that could have been done, she just simply wasn't available to execute.
And she wasn't available because those folks are so overtaxed, right? That's the way the system works when it comes to public defenders.
That is correct. It's not. So when I say that Missouri is ranked 49th as the worst public defender system in the country, that's not because they have the worst people there. Actually, they are the worst funded public defender system in the country, which then puts those lawyers who work for that office at a disadvantage in resources and opportunities to fully execute and defend a capital murder case or a first degree murder case.
You know, at the end of the day, you describe prosecutors as the most powerful players in the criminal justice system. That will surprise people who will assume it's the judges, Ricky. Why do you say it's the prosecutors who are so powerful?
Yeah, the power of a prosecutor is most definitely something that needs to be noted in this country because they have no checks and balances. There are immunity bills or laws. There are no immunity laws or bills that hold them accountable for these type of bad behaviors. And again, there's no checks and balances up top that we normally see in police departments or even with judges. They have the power to charge or not charge an individual. They have the power to do a lot of things within how to charge an individual within our legal system in its unchecked power. You really have to have prosecutors that have morale and a strong feel for integrity when they go into those offices, or they can directly or sometimes indirectly abuse that power.
You just spoke, as I mentioned in the opening, to the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office, and that's where you presented the cost of a prosecutor's decision workshop to them. I mean, there's some irony here, Ricky, because that was the office that put you away for those 23 years. I'm sure that wasn't lost on you during that presentation.
It was not. It was not. It was a surreal moment. It was a surreal moment for me to be back in the Jackson County District Attorney's office, offering support. I call it support, support in a training program that actually connects them with an opportunity to make better decisions. It was also a power, speaking of power, it was a powerful moment for me as well, because what happens to us in life is one thing. How we respond to what happens to us in life is a total different story. I didn't get to pick up the pen and control the narrative as they wrongfully sent me to prison for 23 years, but I get to pick up the pen and control the narrative for what the next 23 years look like. And at that moment, I had an opportunity to do that.
Well, let's talk about your program and some of the points that you wind up raising during it. One of them that you emphasize, understand the personal story of an exoneree. Why is it important for a prosecutor?
Because it's a connecting point. It is how we learn about our senators. It's where we learn about our elected officials, those who are running for office. It's how we learn about our friends. It's how we learn about our coworkers and our colleagues. It's having ability to interact with individuals is where we learn the most and where we gain the most. And if I'm a prosecutor who've not had that opportunity to sit and understand and hear the story of an exoneree, then I just may not be inclined to A, believe that it's a real problem, or even do something about it in the first place. So,
another point, you want folks to become aware of the latest stats and numbers surrounding wrongful convictions in America.
I do. I think it should be a part of prosecutors' continued legal education to know what those numbers are. And those are not numbers that I get to make up, or you get to make up, or our listening audience get to make up. Those are numbers that are coming from the experts. Those are the numbers that are coming from amazing research groups, Dr. Samuel Gross, the National Registry for Exonerations, which Dr. Samuel Gross sits on that board. Barry Scheck sits on that board. Some of the greatest minds in our legal community have studied these issues for decades, and they put out some very, very interesting stats and reports that support it by data. But if I'm a prosecutor that never comes in contact with that information, then how would I know? And so one of the things that we do in the training program is make sure that we cover a section called By the Numbers, and we break a bunch of numbers down so they can better understand.
So we break out the numbers, but your assumption is that those numbers are probably low, right, versus what the in reality numbers might suggest.
Those numbers are low. And just one point to highlight, when we're talking about the registry has been reporting since 1989 as it relates to wrongful convictions, exonerees in this country, and it's a little over 3,000 right now. It's a little over 3,000, but they also have reported, and there's a common belief across the country through all legal communities and Innocence Project, that there's about 5% of the prison population in the United States is believed to be wrongfully convicted. Of that 2.3 million inside that population, or that makes up that population, we're talking about 115,000 individuals across the country believed to be innocent. If we are inclined to be a little more conservative than that and bring that down to perhaps 2%, then we're still talking about a large number of individuals, over 50,000 individuals believed to be languishing in prisons across our country, while only a little over 3,000 has come home. And so it's a small number. It's an important number. The number is ticking up, but we have a long way to go in this country when it comes to addressing the issue of wrongful convictions.
You also want to focus on something called unconscious bias and the role it plays in wrongful convictions. What's that?
Yeah, unconscious bias is the idea that we have biases that we're not aware of. And then we help the prosecutors understand where those biases actually come from, where they come from messaging, where they come from family, where they come from culture, or they environmental biases. And then we also help them see how they show up in their life. And then we help them understand how to counter those biases. Of course, one of the things that I really, really like about this segment that we do during a training of unconscious bias is the result. Most individuals who have taken bias training, and there are many across the country, and they are good bias trainings, but they don't get to see the result of a bias in the room. It's only through theory that they're learning about their bias, but it's another thing to see the actual bias in the room, the result of what a biased decision can produce.
You know, as I mentioned in the opening of this conversation, the prosecutor in your case, Amy McGowan, is facing indefinite suspension of her law license in Missouri because of actions connected to your case. She retired from the Douglas County, Kansas's DA's office back in 2019, shortly after you were released. Will suspending her law license now mean anything to you, or is it too little too late, Ricky?
It's too little too late for me. And it's I think the better question would be, would it mean something to other individuals who may be in her crosshairs in the future if she continues the career of a prosecutor? That's what's more important to me. That's what keeps me up at night. And that's why I would be interested in seeing that she do lose her license and never have the opportunity to victimize another individual or their family.
Well, as you can tell, I've heard Ricky speak any number of times, and if you ever need a great speaker for a group, Ricky Kidd would be a great choice. His website, a way to connect with him, resiliencemode.com. Resilience, that's a key word in what he talks about when he speaks, resiliencemode.com. Ricky, always great to have you on the show. Always enjoy it, and continue with your good work. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate you as well.
Up to Date is a production of KCUR 89.3. Our theme music was composed by the great Bobby Watson. The program is produced by Danny Alexander, Zach Wilson, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Reginald David. Our engineer is Paul Nakatura. I'm Steve Kraske. Thanks for listening.